ourselves suddenly yelling across the dinner table that we are fed up. We need to know what has happened to women and to ourselves so we can find our way back to our feminine souls with as much purpose and clarity as possible. With the connection to my feminine soul broken, I had no idea how to unfold my spiritual life in a way that was natural and genuine for women. I didn't even know there was a feminine way of being spiritual. If I had, I probably couldn't have given myself permission to embrace it. Not then. Disconnected from my feminine soul, I had also unknowingly forfeited my power to name sacred reality. I had simply accepted what men had named. Neither had I noticed that when women give this power away, it is rarely used to liberate and restore value to women. More often, it is used to shore up and enhance the privileged position of men. In the beginnings of Christianity, church fathers debated whether women had souls at all. Later, the issue became whether or not a woman's soul could be saved. Today, the issue is one of women reconnecting with their souls. To reconnect with our souls, we need to claim the freedom and power to shed our conditioning, to tear out the stitches from the old fabric, and to define for ourselves who we are as women, what is sacred, and how we relate to sacred experience. When we finally do that, we will weave new lives and a new era. We will take back our souls once and for all. This shedding and defining, this tearing out stitches and reweaving new ones, became the essential work of my journey. But as author Madonna Kolbenschlag wrote, "Much testing, much reflecting, much living must intervene before we can say, my soul is my own." Sleep dust. Like the Sandman from the nursery tale, who stole into the children's rooms and put them to sleep by sprinkling sleep dust over them, our culture, even the culture of our faith, has helped anesthetize the feminine spirit. I like the way Clarissa Pinkola Estes says it. When a woman is exhorted to be compliant, cooperative, and quiet, to not make upset or go against the old guard, she is pressed into living a most unnatural life, a life that is self-blinding, without innovation. The worldwide issue for women is that under such conditions they are not only silenced, they are put to sleep. Their concerns, their viewpoints, their own truths are vaporized. The sleep seems to descend on females early in life. Studies conducted by Harvard professor Carol Gilligan and Colby College professor Lynn Michael Brown from 1986 to 1990 have revealed that something truly phenomenal happens to girls around adolescence. They undergo a gradual change in which they lose their feisty spirit, courage, and willingness to speak out, qualities they had known in girlhood. Around this time, their truth becomes silenced, held back. They become afraid of conflict with males because they know on some level that males hold the power. They become, perhaps forever, good little girls, settling into the clichés and limits imposed on their gender. So sleep begins. For some, it can extend throughout life as unconsciousness deepens and numbness sets in. These women lose all memory of the problem they once saw. For other women, the sleep is more fitful. They sometimes glimpse the truth, but it never seems to rouse them fully. These women tend to fall back asleep when the waking state becomes threatening. But whether our sleep is sound or partial, when we are cut off from our feminine source, from the feminine divine, symptoms inevitably break through. Although outwardly appearing stable and satisfied, inwardly we may feel silenced, afraid, stuck, self-doubtful, unable to carry through with things, angry but unable to express it directly. We may grow perfectionistic and driven, but strangely at the same time, we may feel powerless, without boundaries, overwhelmed with the roles we are expected to carry out. Moreover, we may harbor fears of being left alone, of risking ourselves, of conflict. In my mid to late 30s, before my awakening began, I was experiencing many of these symptoms, yet I was unable to see that they were trying to tell me something, that they were voices urging me to drop deep into my own feminine nature. wake-up calls. Even on the literal level, waking was always hard for me. I have had only one nickname in my life, given to me by my brother, 11 years younger than I. He called me Sue Up, a name he made up for me when he was a toddler and I a young adolescent. At that time, I'd sleep so soundly that alarm clocks could not get through to me, and I would wake only after being shaken a half dozen times. Each morning, people in my family would go around asking, "Is Sue up?" My little brother, who was learning to speak, thought this was my name. Now beginning to wake up at 38, I realized that once again I'd been living up to my old nickname. As a woman, I'd slept so soundly that wake-up calls had not really gotten through to me. Not the feminist movement, not the marginalization of women in the church, not exclusive male language in scripture and liturgy. I had been upset and alarmed by the staggering assault on women through rape, spousal abuse, sexual abuse, harassment, and genital mutilation. But somehow this didn't initiate a full-blown awakening. I'd been disturbed by a stream of statistics, such as 4 times as many girls die worldwide of malnutrition as boys, because boys are preferred and given more food, or the fact that women do 2/3 of the work in the world and receive 1/10 of the world's wages, or that American women earn 75% of what similarly employed men do and comprise only 2% of top management. But neither did this rouse my feminine heart in the sort of way that propels one into a life-changing journey. The first fictional story I ever wrote was about a woman who walked in her sleep nearly every night. "People deposit their misery somewhere in their body," the character Hallie says. "Mine apparently is the sleep center of my brain." But despite her awareness that her sleepwalking signals something wrong in her life, she refuses to face her life or her problems. Then one night she sleepwalks outside and climbs a ladder that has been left leaning against the house. She wakes 3 rungs from the top, everything around her darkness and air. Frightened, she backs down and returns to her room, where she ties her arm to the bedpost, afraid she'll sleep again and wake on the roof, this time stepping off into thin air. But even then, she doesn't confront the changes she needs to make. So she walks in her sleep again, this time backing the car down the driveway and crashing into a Japanese elm. It takes the crash to wake her. She sits at the wheel, stunned, a trickle of blood on her forehead, knowing finally that she must alter the direction of her life. Here is one of the principles of women waking. If you don't respond to the first gentle nudges, they will increase in intensity. Next, you will wake up on the roof, and if you do not respond to that, there will likely be a crash. There are women who sleep through the crashes, too. I imagine by then the impulse to wake gives up, and they drift into permanent hibernation. Why in the world do women sleep through all manner of wake-up calls? I think part of it is because we use psychological sleep as a way of avoiding pain. Our choice, as Florence Nightingale put it, is between pain and paralysis, a hard one. But it's only when we are willing to see the truth about our lives as women, however painful that truth might be, that we enter the portal of the journey. That November, 2 months after the dream of giving birth to myself, I had a real collision with the truth. It would be my driveway crash. The Nest of Yellow Leaves. The monastery visit I'd planned was supposed to be just another routine retreat. When I arrived, dusk was falling. I strolled to the church along a sidewalk covered with so many fallen leaves that it was like walking on one long yellow carpet. I sat through Vespers, listening to the monks chant the office, hopelessly trying to follow them in the prayer book, but nevertheless swept into the strange beauty of the chant. Afterward, I waited outside the church for a monk named Father Pascal, who was to be my spiritual director during the retreat. Standing ankle-deep in leaves, I watched the monks file out in their black hooded robes, and I wondered which one Father Pascal might be. He would have no problem spotting me. I was the only female in the whole place. Suddenly, I heard a little cough behind me, and turning, saw a smiling man with shaven dark hair and round glasses. "I'm Father Pascal," he said. At that moment, I opened my mouth and uttered what is undoubtedly the most embarrassing Freudian slip of my life. I said, "Hello, I'm Father Sue." He got a funny look on his face. Heat flared in my cheeks. "Are you feeling nervous about being here?" he asked, attributing my word slip to anxiousness. I hated to tell him that no, actually I was an old hand at monasteries. "I must be," I said. We chatted a while longer, though I don't recall a thing we said after that. My face stayed warm a good half hour. Back in my room, I thought about my strange slip of the tongue. It hadn't come from nervousness, like Father Pascal suggested. So why did I say that? Maybe it was an indication of just how at home I felt in monastic places, that I had become one of them. Sure, that's gotta be it, I thought. But some other part of me suspected the real truth, one too bitter to let in. That part in my unconscious, knowing and wise, was telling me exactly who I was identified with. It was telling me that my values, my spirituality, my way of being a woman in the world were masculine through and through. I was immersed in the world of the Father. Father Sue, I wanted to cry. The next morning I rose and went for a walk, taking pen and journal. I walked toward a small stand of trees at the edge of the monastery, where I picked my way through young pines, half-bare maples and bramble, until I came to a small hidden clearing. It was wall-to-wall yellow leaves and dappled light. Impulsively, I took armfuls of leaves and plumped them into a big pile to sit on. When I finished, the mound resembled the kind of nest Big Bird of Sesame Street would require. Almost laughing, I wrote in my journal, "I'm here in the woods sitting on a big nest of leaves." I laid down my pen. "You know what?" I thought. "Maybe I made this big nest because I'm here to hatch my new life, to give birth to something." I remembered the dream of giving birth to myself, to the female life that wanted to come into being, and immediately, surprisingly, my eyes filled with tears. I sat still. I wrote, "So then what's standing in the way of this new life being born?" And it came to me all at once. "For one thing, you're going to have to forgive yourself for not being born male. You're going to have to learn to love your real female life." I sat there open-mouthed. What? That was ridiculous. Of course I loved being a woman. I reveled in my femaleness. But the inner voice was not talking about my surface revelings in being feminine. It was telling me something much more complex. It was telling me that I'd lost the voice of my native soul, or, as novelist Ursula K. Le Guin put it, the innate mother tongue. I had learned instead to speak the father tongue, the dominant cultural language. Inside, I felt like something submerged in me from the beginning of time had slit the surface. Some awful, sunken truth I didn't want to acknowledge had floated up to awareness. Maybe that humiliating Father Sue comment had dislodged it, or maybe the comment was merely the debris of a truth already rising. For a moment, I tried to pretend the thought hadn't come, but it was too late. My body had recognized it as the truth even before my mind could allow it. My heart was thudding, and my stomach was doing slow rolls into my chest. Next, I was crying one of those shoulder-shaking cries. A girl, I thought. I was born a girl with three brothers. I felt utterly cheated. My anguish was so intense it shocked me. It was as if I felt inferior simply for being female, that as a woman I was damaged goods or at least seconds. I had somehow never known this about myself. It was terrible to admit, but even worse was feeling the pain that came with it. I thought, if I'd been born male, dear God, the things I could have done. I longed for parity with men, the freedom and choices of men, the ability to quest without worrying about who would cook dinner or pick up the children. I longed for the power men had to name the world, for the world had been largely male-defined. Even God himself was defined by men and envisioned in their image. Being female had always seemed vaguely limiting, confining, lacking in power, second class. As I tried to understand why, I found myself thinking about Eve. Some words played in my head, the old litany about women I'd heard in church. Second in creation and first to sin. Some years before, the Southern Baptist denomination had passed a resolution saying that women should not have a place of authority over men in church because of this. It had come straight out of the Epistle of 1 Timothy, chapter 2, verses 11 to 14, written in the 2nd century. Let a woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over men. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Revised Standard Version. As I brooded over this, I remembered the first time I'd heard the words, first to sin, second in creation. The memory was still vivid, undulled after more than 25 years. It was a Sunday morning, and I was around 12. I sat in church in my childhood Georgia with my mother and father and two of my three younger brothers. We were listening to a visiting preacher give a sermon. It had to do with the God-ordained family. The preacher had a portable chalkboard beside the pulpit, and on it he diagrammed the family for us. He wrote God at the top, then in a descending chain of command he wrote husband, wife, children. I remembered the downward-pointing arrows he drew between each word, showing us the line of authority. When he got to the part about why wives were below husbands, I was on the edge of my pew. Woman was the first to sin and the second to be created, he said. Then he went on to talk about Eve, how she was created for man's benefit, that she was unworthy because she disobeyed God and offered Adam the forbidden fruit. It was just like that day in Vacation Bible School when the teacher had informed us the Bible put men in charge. I felt the same rush of disbelief and betrayal. By then I'd heard the message many times, but that day it fell like the proverbial last straw, the one that breaks the female camel's back. I listened to this man of God taking his message right out of what we considered to be the truest book of all. A feeling of pressure built in my chest, almost the same feeling I got at the city pool when I stayed underwater too long. I looked down the pew at my mother to get her reaction. Her eyes had glazed over. She looked like she'd heard it at least 500 times before. I looked at the other women. Same there. I wanted to stand up and say indignantly that this wasn't so, but none of them looked the least bit perturbed. My heart sank. If I could have put the feeling into words, I would have said, God, how could you? The so-called God-ordained image of female as under male, incapable, disobedient, unworthy, all of which added up to inferior, was a devastating notion to me as a girl. It snuffed out something vital, some hope for my female life. When I left church that day, real doubt had set in about the value of being a girl. Years later, when I came upon some words by theologian Elizabeth A. Johnson, I felt the deep click of truth inside. She said that experiences like the one I had give girl children from the beginning the experience of a world where the male is the norm from which her own self deviates. Over the years, the idea of being other, of being the lesser sex, had continued to seep into me. I saw now it had penetrated the marrow of my tiniest bones. That day in the nest of leaves outside the monastery, I came to know this for the first time. It was a moment of awakening. I had touched the wound of my feminine life. The Feminine Wound. When I returned home from the monastery, I wasn't quite the same. Oh, I tried to be. The holiday season was coming, and I thought if I dived into it full force, the pain would be forgotten. I shelved my journal. The children and I went shopping. We dragged out decorations, drove to the country, and cut greenery. We put so much evergreen in the house, Sandy said it looked like we were celebrating Arbor Day. I went crazy baking things, and I don't even like to bake. I also created new writing projects for myself. I did what I could to blot out the recognition that there was a feminine journey to be made, and it was probably going to be the most arduous, most revolutionary experience of my life. Feminist theologian Carol P. Christ states that a woman's awakening begins with an experience of nothingness. It comes as she experiences emptiness, self-negation, disillusionment, a deep felt recognition of the limitation placed on women's lives, especially her own. An experience of nothingness was what I encountered at the monastery. In tasting what it meant to be female in my culture and faith, I felt for the first time a hidden despair lodged inside. At the time, I had delusions that I was probably the only woman in the world with a wound like that. Later, I would be surprised to discover that most women carry this wound, though it is usually buried and unnamed. Psychotherapist Ann Wilson Schaaf's name for this wound is the original sin of being born female. She writes, "To be born female in this culture means that you are born tainted, that there is something intrinsically wrong with you that you can never change, that your birthright is one of innate inferiority. I am not implying that this must remain so. I do believe that we must know this and understand it as a given before it can be worked through." Of course, being female is not inferior at all, but that doesn't change the fact that women have often experienced it that way. Messages of inferiority and self-denial are passed to us all our lives, messages that we should deny our own experiences, feelings, and needs. We absorb them in an ongoing process of osmosis that creates and enlarges the wound's core. Early on, a girl starts to soak up the idea that she is less than boys. Not long ago, my friend Betty told me about the day she and her husband walked beside the rapids of the Chattooga River and came upon a young family. Betty watched as the father took the boy, who looked about 4 years old, down to the water's edge so he could dip his hands into the surging water and feel the spray on his face. The boy's sister, slightly older, begged her mother to take her to the edge, too. "No," the mother told her, "it's too dangerous there." A small incident, but when multiplied 100, 1,000 times in a little girl's life, she learns that she's not as capable as a boy of handling life on the edge. She learns to hang back. Peggy Orenstein's 1994 book, Schoolgirls, draws on a 1991 survey by the American Association of University Women, which suggests that parents and teachers seem to have lesser expectations for girls than for boys. Orenstein showed that girls' self-esteem is lost as they dumb themselves down and conform to lesser expectations to avoid being threatening. The girls in her study learned by adolescence not to be too outspoken, too aggressive, or too smart. They learned to balance drive with deference. The boys, by contrast, were rewarded for their drive and discouraged from showing deference. Girls learned to negate themselves through simple experiences. On the playground, calling a boy a girl was the worst slur possible. Orenstein also found that boys received more attention from teachers than did girls. In many of the classrooms she visited, boys were called on more often. Even at home, many of the schoolgirls felt their brothers were favored, that the boys were, in fact, listened to more than they. At church, girls fare no better. A young girl learns Bible stories in which vital women are generally absent, in the background, or devoid of power. She learns that men go on quests, encounter God, and change history, while women support and wait for them. She hears sermons where traditional, non-threatening, feminine roles are lifted up as God's ideal. A girl is likely to see only a few women in the higher echelons of church power. And what does a girl who is forming her identity do with all the scriptures admonishing women to submission and silence? Having them explained away as the product of an ancient time does not entirely erase her unease. She also experiences herself missing from pronouns in scripture, hymns, and prayers. And most of all, as long as God himself is exclusively male, she will experience the otherness the lessness of herself. All the pious talk in the world about females being equal to males will fail to compute in the deeper places inside her. As a girl absorbs her culture, for instance, as she watches movies and television, she may also come to understand that her real importance derives from her relationship with men and boys, by how good she looks for them, or how well she takes care of them. She will notice the things traditionally assigned to women, keeping a home, cleaning, cooking, laundry, child-rearing, and grow aware of how little value these things seem to have in the world compared to the things men typically do. When she grows up and enters the workplace, she will likely plunge into the staggering dilemma that is often hers alone, working while caring for children and keeping a house. She'll likely encounter ceilings, networks, and traditional assumptions that work against her as a woman. She will arrive at the disconcerting realization that success comes only as she learns to modulate and adapt her feminine self to a man's world. If she sees few women in places of real power, hears few female voices of strength, and witnesses little female creativity, then despite what is said to her about women's equality, she experiences women and herself as absent and silent. The feminine wound is created as we internalize all these experiences, the voices we hear at church, school, home, work, and within the culture at large, suggesting in ways both bold and subtle that women and feminine experience are less than. If you receive often enough the message that women are inferior and secondary, you will soon believe you are inferior and secondary. As a matter of fact, many experts tell us that all women in our society arrive at adulthood with significant feelings of inadequacy. Once on an airplane, I sat beside a 30-year-old woman with a briefcase. As we chatted, a female voice came over the loudspeaker and said, "This is your captain." The woman stopped mid-sentence. "Oh, no," she said. "A woman pilot." "I'm sure she's well-trained," I said. "Right," she said, "but she's still a woman." Her feminine wound, her personal concentration of female inferiority, had made a brief appearance. As time went on, I would grasp how deep such wounds go. For we carry not only our own wounding experiences, but the inherited wounds of our mothers and grandmothers as well. "We think back through our mothers and grandmothers, if we are women," Virginia Woolf said. This statement is not mere poetry. We carry something ancient inside us, an aspect of the psyche that Carl Jung called the collective unconscious. Containing riverbeds of collective experience, the collective unconscious is the place where pre-existing traces of ancestral experience are encoded. Thousands of years of feminine rejection reside there, and it can rise up to do a dark dance with our conscious beliefs. I read a moving example of this interplay in physician Christiane Northrup's book, Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom. She recounted being in the delivery room countless times, hearing new mothers apologize to their husbands when the baby was not male. She described the experience as staggering to her. But, she writes, "When my own second daughter was born, I was shocked to hear those very words of apology come into my brain from the collective unconscious of the human race. I never said them out loud, and yet they were there in my head, completely unbidden. I realized then how old and ingrained is this rejection of the female by men and women alike." For Northrup, as for me, recognizing this wound in herself was a pivotal moment in her growth as a woman. There's always the danger, though, that as we open our eyes to the social, physical, psychological, and spiritual violence done to women throughout history, not to mention the wounding in our own personal histories, we will become paralyzed by a sense of victimization. For me, opening my eyes to the feminine wound was rather like getting hit by a stun gun. I felt knocked down by the force of it, and for a short while I didn't get up. On some level, I felt overwhelmed by the depth of the feminine wound, which I was uncovering not only in myself, but all around. The danger of getting stuck in feelings of victimization is real, but nevertheless, recognizing the feminine wound is important, because in the end, it's the only way we can stop being victims. We can't change anything until we acknowledge the problem. I'd been an unconscious victim before my awakening began. Discovering the truth was waking me up to my victimization, but it was also making it possible for me to move beyond it. Feminist writer Naomi Wolf has especially cautioned women not to shape our identity as victims. Yet shaping our identity as victims is quite different from naming the truth of our victimization in order to work against it and live into our power. If women don't document and protest the harm done to us, who will? As Wolf says, women are not natural victims, but they sure are victimized. While holding on to the awareness, then, that we must not fall into shaping our identity as victims, we have to tell ourselves the flat-out truth, as my grandmother used to call it. And the flat-out truth is that we have come into a world, into a church or faith tradition, that for millennia has believed us inferior. It is a tradition permeated by an authoritarian attitude that devalues, diminishes, rejects, and limits women and the feminine. But seeing such truth can be dangerous. Philosopher Mary Daly reminds us, it isn't prudent for women to see all of this. Seeing means that everything changes, the old identifications and the old securities are gone. The question, she says, is whether women can forego prudence in favor of courage. That was the question that followed me as I made my way into the new year. Winter of Resistance. I call the first winter of my awakening the winter of resistance. It was marked by persistent attempts to ignore the groundswell of pain and awareness that had erupted at the monastery and the new consciousness that wanted in. One day I pulled the slender volume Children's Letters to God from a bookshelf and came upon this letter from a little girl named Sylvia. Dear God, are boys better than girls? I know you are one, but try to be fair. Sylvia. Tears floated to my eyes. Why did questions like these inhabit little girls and grown women, and when did we lose our courage to confront God with them? I threw on a coat and left the house, hoping a walk would offer diversion. Outside it was cold and bright with winter sun. I walked to a neighborhood lake, sat on the grass, and watched a flotilla of ducks glide across the water in a perfect V. I'd told no one about my experience at the monastery or the things it was kindling inside me. I wondered now if I should find someone trusted and pour out my experience. But did I really want to open up that hidden pocket of pain? Expressing it aloud to someone would hold me accountable to it in a whole new way. And frankly, I didn't know yet if I wanted to own up to the wound I'd vividly uncovered. Mostly, I didn't want to believe I could have been wounded by my own faith. I didn't want to acknowledge how it had relegated half the human population to secondary status and invisible places. I didn't want any of this to be true. The ground was starting to feel cold. Out on the lake, wind made scalloped patterns in the water. I drew my knees to my chin, trying to muffle a throbbing space in my chest. I felt alone and unequipped for upheavals such as this. If I pursued this journey, there would be so much to unravel, so much to unlearn. Later, I would read Ursula K. Le Guin's comment, "I am a slow unlearner, but I love my unteachers." I, too, was a slow unlearner. The problem was I didn't have any unteachers. I didn't personally know anyone close at hand who'd gone through a feminist spiritual awakening. How did one do it? Did I dare step over the boundaries church and convention had drawn for women? Did I dare venture beyond the place where my mother had stopped? No, no, no. I got up from the edge of the water and walked home. It was the prudence or courage question again. That day, I chose prudence. In the following weeks, I tried to ignore the monastery experience altogether, but as the days grew darker and the trees barer, it pushed unbidden into my thoughts. I could not seem to banish my awakening, so I did the next best thing. I trivialized it. One of the primary forms that resistance takes is trivialization. Surely I was making a big deal out of this, I began to tell myself. So maybe there is a feminine wound in me, in women, in the church, in the earth. But what about all those other major problems I should be concerned about? The environment, crime, war, homelessness. What is a little feminine wound by comparison? Yet the truth is, as long as one woman is dehumanized, none of us can be fully human. Once during that time, I abandoned prudence for courage. While at a party, the subject of women's dedication to the church came up. "But for all our dedication, we've certainly gotten a rotten deal," I said. It is the sort of thing waking women blurt almost without realizing it. A man rolled his eyes at the ceiling. "Oh, no," he said. "You're not one of those women, are you?"
"What women?" I asked.
"You know, those screaming feminists who are always yelling about how bad women have been treated."
"No,"
I told him fast as I could. "I'm not one of those." And I dropped the subject as if it was toxic waste. He had effectively dismissed my voice and experience. But then it hit me. Wasn't that what I'd been doing to myself? Dismissing my own experience? The voice speaking deep inside? Trivializing our experience is a very old and shrewd way of controlling ourselves. We do it by censoring our expressions of truth or viewing them as inconsequential. We learned the technique from a culture that has practiced it like an art form. The trick works like this. An image is created of a screaming feminist with an axe to grind. The image takes on enormous negative energy in the church and culture. Branding a woman with this image effectively belittles her opinion and discredits it. So rather than risk the image being attached to her, a woman will often back quickly away. I later realized that's what I'd done when the man threatened to attach the label to me. It is a rare and strong woman who has enough inner substance to face the ridicule and pain that can come from expressing feminism. The church itself has used this negative image as a way of controlling women and discouraging them from challenging the status quo. Once when I suggested to a woman that she stand up for women in a church situation, she said, "I really want to, but I'd hate to look like one of those fanatical feminists our minister preaches about." Sometimes, though, others' attempts to control and trivialize don't work. Once when I led a discussion at a mixed-gender retreat, a couple of women began to express their pain as women within Christianity. A male clergyman, who I suspect was feeling uncomfortable, said, "Oh, come on. The church is human. It makes mistakes. Why can't you just forgive and be done with it?" I'm not sure he realized what he'd done, brilliantly trivializing and dismissing their feelings. I mean, who could argue with what he said? Yes, the church is human. Yes, it makes mistakes. Yes, forgiveness is good. There is a time to be gentle and a time to be fierce, and each of the two women managed to be both at the same time. Each spoke fierce things with a tone of gentleness. One said, "Must you focus on my need to forgive and let go? I'm not yet at a place where I can do that. I really need to express what's inside me, and I need the church to listen. Why not go to the heart of it and focus on the church's need to repent and change?" The other woman said, "Think a moment. If men were at the bottom and women were the ones in charge, if our theology tended to give us the power and excluded you, if it deified the feminine only, would you still be saying, 'The church is only human, why don't you just let it go?'" She brought to my mind the comment by Nell Morton, one of the grandmothers of feminist spirituality, who said things are always different when you are looking from the bottom up. This looking from the bottom up is the catalyst for a reversal of consciousness, not only for ourselves, but also for the most resistant among us. For when we stop perceiving, assuming, and theorizing from the top, the dominant view, and instead go to the bottom of the social pyramid and identify with those who are oppressed and disenfranchised, a whole new way of relating opens up. Until we look from the bottom up, we have seen nothing. Maybe that's what happened to the man. Maybe the women's gentleness opened his eyes, and their fierceness forced him to perceive from the bottom up. Because he was quiet for a while, then he said, "I think I see what you mean." As the first spring of my awakening approached and I struggled to see, I grew less and less prudent. I would look at my daughter and think how I didn't want her female life wounded,
I didn't want it wounded by the church or my own unconsciousness. Neither did I want my husband or my son to remain unconscious. And how would the cycle be broken? How would patterns be redeemed if I kept resisting? And I couldn't help feeling a growing discontent with my female life, flashes of anger and sadness about the way it is. My attention was being drawn more and more to symptoms that cropped up inside me from time to time. I began to ask myself, why do I sometimes feel tentative and self-doubtful? Why do I silence my real self? Why do I fall into driven and perfectionistic patterns? Why do I occasionally lapse into passivity, afraid to rock the boat? Why do I work so hard to fulfill outward expectations? Why does it matter that I please everyone? Are these things emanating from the feminine wound? And how can I keep ignoring them? My dreams were full of earthquakes and floods, old buildings crumbling and washing away. I was still reluctant to open myself up to the quaking and torrents inside, but the dream voice was telling me that whether I chose to recognize it or not, I was in the midst of upheaval. Something was toppling, and I'd better pay attention. Dancing Women. In May, I attended a Journey into Wholeness conference on St. Simon Island off the coast of Georgia, a conference that explored the concepts of C.G. Jung. Toward the end of the conference week, around 40 or 50 women decided to go to the beach and have something they were calling a full moon celebration. I don't know what possessed me to go along. I suppose curiosity. Maybe some intuition that this was a moment to be seized, a now or never moment. So I found myself following a long line of women winding through the sand dunes, walking by the light of a large moon suspended over the ocean. As the sound of the surf swelled in the distance, I felt the urge to turn back. But we'd all come together in several cars and a couple of vans. There was nothing to do now but get through it. Someone had brought along a Native American drum, and she began to beat it as we wound through sea oats and darkness. On the beach, we gathered driftwood and built a fire, then sat around it. The women began to sing, laugh, tell stories. They talked about their lives as women, their struggles to bring forth an authentic female life. There was an awful lot of talk about the Great Mother, whoever she was, and being connected to the earth and the moon, whatever that meant. I hugged my knees tight and didn't say a word. As their sense of feminine celebration rose, and since these women were being their instinctual selves and nothing else, a whole lot of them got up and danced. They twirled and swayed along the border of waves. Treading into the water, they dipped it up with their hands and tossed it toward the sky, letting it fall around them like wedding rice. Playing and dancing, casting fluid shadows on the beach, they looked half real to me, like mermaids who'd swum ashore and found their legs. I sat dazed by the whole thing. It was like landing on Venus. I don't think I'd ever felt so awkward, bewildered, or unsettled in my life, yet I was mesmerized. These women were embodying an experience of their femininity I knew nothing about. They seemed to truly love their womanhood. They didn't appear to doubt their thoughts and feelings as women. Instead, they seemed naturally themselves, self-defined, self-connected. Then, almost against my will, I flashed back to that day at the monastery 6 months earlier. Father Sue, I thought. It had never been so clear to me as then how far I had drifted from my feminine instinct, how much I had lost my way as a woman. I remembered recognizing at the time that I needed to birth a new life, one that had something to do with loving my female self and finding my way back to the deep authenticity of it. I'd tried over the last few months to suppress the memory, but here on the beach with these women, the need to suppress it left me completely. I knew I could not ignore this journey. I did not want to. Someone who'd danced far down the beach found a huge sea turtle shell that had washed ashore, and she came back to share her find. I trekked down with a small group to inspect it. We stared at the hulk of shell, while water lapped around our bare ankles. "I feel like the shell is a gift to us," a woman said. "A sign." Another woman, who was a student of ancient mythology, told us that the turtle was a feminine symbol of strength and wisdom. Did you know that in some ancient cultures, the turtle shell was considered the base and support of the universe? It was said the whole world axis sat on her back. Silence fell as we stared at the carapace, ink gold beneath the moon. One by one, the women began to dance again, dipping to brush their hands across the shell as they circled it, as if they were touching the source of feminine support, wisdom, and strength. It was a ritual of deep beauty that I could only watch from the edge. But when the women finally walked back up the beach, I lagged behind just long enough to brush my hand across the shell. Acts of Naming. After I returned home from the conference, I had a talk with my friend Betty. We'd met at a women's luncheon 5 years earlier and had become good friends. That evening, I poured out my story to her, the awakening that was trying to unfold in me, the resistance I'd felt, the experience at the monastery, what had happened to me on the beach. I said it out loud to another woman. Besides scrawling words in my journal, this was my first real act of naming my experience. She listened, nodding. Finally, she said, "I don't know why we haven't talked about this sooner. My awakening began over a year ago." As we talked, we discovered we had something profound in common, a journey to find our female souls. After that, we began to meet regularly to talk about our lives as women. We met all summer and into the fall and on and on. It became a mutual process of self-discovery. We debated ideas and books we were reading, pondered new contexts of spiritual meaning for women. Together, over time, we named our lives as women, named our wounds, named our sacred realities. To say it very simply, we helped each other. Going to another woman for help can be a breakthrough act, because throughout history, women have been programmed to turn to men for help. We might go to other women for solace, for domestic wisdom, but for solutions and insight, to find out how the world works and how to name reality, many women tend to go to men, to male experts, teachers, fathers, husbands, older brothers, priests, and ministers. Certainly we can find real help there. I have been encouraged and blessed by enlightened men. But it alters something inside a woman when she begins to turn also to women, to see women and therefore herself as namers of reality. My experience on the beach and my discussion with Betty gave me the courage to begin to see myself and other women this way. To name is to define and shape reality. For eons, women have accepted male naming as a given, especially in the spiritual realm. The fact is, for a long time now, men have been naming the world, God, sacred reality, and even women from their own masculine perspective and experience, and then calling it universal experience. As feminist culture critic Elizabeth Dodson Gray points out, this naming tended to benefit men's needs and concerns, and in lots of cases to oppress women. Was it such a wild thought that women might start naming God, sacred reality, and their own lives themselves? I wondered how the world might have been different if women had been equally involved in the act of naming. How might sacred experience be different? How might we as women be different? Would there be a feminine wound for us to name and heal? Naming allows a woman to embrace her own experience, to utter her female truth, perhaps for the first time. Since my waking had been precipitated by an encounter with feminine woundedness, as it frequently is for women, that summer I began the process of naming by acknowledging and expressing the feminine wound in myself. In an interview, novelist Alice Walker says, "You think you can avoid pain, but actually you can't. If you do, you just get sicker, or you feel more pain. But if you can speak it, if you can write it, if you can paint it, it is very healing." I began to paint pictures of my wounded female life. Through the summer, I painted images that were painful and even startling to me. As I painted, deeply buried emotions boiled to the surface. They were emotions that for many years had influenced my behavior in unconscious but profound ways. Unacknowledged feelings about our womanhood operate like the so-called wizard in Oz who sits hidden behind the curtain pulling strings, creating large, unwanted, sometimes frightening effects. Not only do they control our lives in unwanted ways, but unfelt feelings stay in the body like small ticking time bombs, says Christiane Northrup. They are illnesses in incubation. A lot of women have told me, I don't really know what I'm feeling half the time. Perhaps that's because when uncomfortable feelings come, we push them aside. After a while, we've blocked them so well for so long that they no longer get through at all. Once we begin to acknowledge wounded feelings, though, it's almost a relief. We may feel like Dorothy when her dog Toto drew aside the curtain, exposing the man who was scaring everyone with his behind-the-scenes machinations. We can see then what has been controlling a lot of our life. We can see where the self-doubt, the silencing, the drivenness, the need to fulfill collective expectations come from. But most of all, in seeing the wound for what it is, we take charge, just as Dorothy, seeing the wizard for what he was, mobilized herself to stand up to him. I found myself painting a woman without feet, a woman without a mouth, a woman without hands. Why these mutilated women? In painting my female life without feet, I was uncovering an inability to stand firmly on my own feminine ground, to stand up to others or stand up for myself. Several years after I painted those images, I was visiting the High Museum in Atlanta when I came upon a striking sculpture of a pair of feet. Just feet, from the ankles down. They were surrounded by a field of large glass spheres that appeared to be oversized teardrops. The title of the work was Mother. So there are our feet, I thought, in this bed of tears. I felt the artist Kiki Smith had captured the universal severing of women from their female standpoint. In painting a woman without a mouth, I was revealing to myself a female life unable to adequately voice the feminine self, which is always a woman's truest voice. The woman without hands spoke to me about a life severed from the power to grasp one's deep life as woman, to hold on to one's inherent power. One day that summer, while browsing in a small shop, I happened upon an illustration of the Virgin Mary, drawn in detail except for one thing. She had no hands. As I looked at the print, I realized that over the long course of church history, Mary had been the closest thing Christianity had to an archetype of the feminine divine. For many, she filled the vacuum in the divine image and came to represent the feminine side. She was referred to as Queen of Heaven, Lady All Holy, Sovereign Mistress of the World. Yet at the same time, Mary was portrayed as a humble, submissive, untainted virgin, the lowliest of handmaids, whose compliant response was, "Let it be done to me according to your word," a response women have mirrored in virtually every relationship in their lives. In the Baptist tradition, we'd prefaced most conversations about Mary by saying, "She was just a woman," emphasizing her lesser place. In fact, if the Christmas story hadn't been read once a year in the Baptist churches I'd attended, it would have been easy to forget Jesus had a mother at all. In the shop that day, I remembered the one and only experience with Mary I'd had as a child. I was spending the night at the home of a Catholic family, and on the mantel in the guest bedroom was a porcelain statue of Mary. Standing upon a sliver of crescent moon, she was a mystery that called up an inexplicable rush of feeling. I experienced what I suppose could be called the magnetic pull to the feminine divine. With a gesture of spontaneous adoration, I reached out and touched her, whispering the only words for her I knew, "Hail Mary." Later, I questioned my veneration of the feminine figure. I felt as though I'd eaten a forbidden fruit. As the memory faded, I stared at the handless Mary in the picture. The omission of her hands made me wonder, was the handless Sue I'd been drawing connected to the handless Mary? Did a wounded and diminished feminine life emerge in part from a wounded and diminished feminine divine? Did reclaiming my feminine hands have something to do with reclaiming a feminine divinity? It was a thought wildly new to me. I could do nothing at the time but tuck it quietly away. I simply went on doing the only things I knew to do at this point in my waking, acknowledge and express my feminine experience as best as I could, mostly through art and journaling. And I went on saying it out loud to Betty, who received it with the tender words, "I know, Sue. All of us down deep know." Faces of Daughterhood. One morning, when summer had nearly burned itself out, I woke to the sound of rain. I went to my study and sat before my sketches and paintings of the wounded female life, the handless, footless, mouthless women. For months I'd been acknowledging my feminine wound, but now I felt a need to let it go, or at least symbolize its going in a ritual of foretelling. When the rain stopped, I burned the drawings one by one on the patio, then stared at the heap of cinder left behind. It was this sight, the small lump of cinder and aftermath, that filled me suddenly with a need to understand how the feminine wound had affected my life. What sort of ash and fallout had it deposited? What patterns had it instilled? I bent down and touched the cooled cinders, letting them move through the sieve of my fingers, aware that the next part of my awakening lay in probing those questions, going even deeper into the act of naming myself. Or was it an unnaming I was about to take up? Sometimes you have to unname something before you can define it for yourself. The morning after I burned my pictures marked a pivotal moment in my unnaming. As I stood in the garden picking what was left of the tomatoes, an awareness splintered into my thoughts. I am grown, with children of my own, but inside, I am still a daughter. A daughter is a woman who remains internally dependent, who does not shape her identity and direction as a woman, but tends to accept the identity and direction projected onto her. She tends to become the image of woman that the cultural father idealizes. My simple self-confession was a deceptively powerful one, for in making it, I took my first distinct, albeit tiny, step away from identifying myself as a dependent person. I began to observe myself as daughter instead of merely being one. After that, it became increasingly clear to me that much of the way I lived and related as a woman, and many of the female patterns in my life, were, in fact, hidden adaptations to the feminine wound. They were the many faces of my daughterhood. A wound to the psyche often causes the same response as a wound to the body, compensation. For example, if you severely injure an ankle, the connective tissue or fascia in that area will remold around the trauma, trying to compensate for the damage. You may begin to walk a little differently, to favor the other side ever so slightly. If this keeps up, over time your posture will change. Whole new patterns of maintaining your structure will emerge, as bones, soft tissues, and tendons realign themselves. We respond to the feminine wound in a similar way, by making subtle but in the long run profound postural shifts in the psyche. Our psyches begin to realign and remold to compensate for the damage, usually favoring the other side. For instance, if the feminine ankle is crippled, we learn to shift our weight to the standpoint of strength. That is, we compensate by identifying with and supporting male dominance. We become good daughters to the cultural father. One of the more delicate phases in the waking process is accepting how we've been complicit. Simone de Beauvoir pointed out, for instance, that women themselves condition their daughters to serve the system of male primacy. If a daughter challenges it, the mother will generally defend the system rather than her daughter. These mothers, victims themselves, have unwittingly become wounded wounders. Women need to attack culture's oppression of women, for there truly is a godlike socializing power that induces women to buy in or collude. But we also need to confront our own part in accepting male dominance and take responsibility where appropriate. I knew I would have to come to grips with how I'd bought into patriarchy. I would have to look hard at my own daughterhood. Cultural blueprints. Early that autumn, my husband and I traveled to New York, where we visited an exhibition of Magritte's paintings. In one painting, an ordinary-looking man in a suit was holding a brush and painting an actual woman into existence in his living room.